McGinn delivers. Quinn! Paul Quinn has done it! Now they are believing! It was time to deliver for Aberdeen! That's the way to go about it, even with 10 men!
Good evening and welcome to the latest By the Minute Aberdeen podcast. Joining me tonight, I've got Grant Fiskin. Evening, Grant.
Evening, Richard.
Martin Clunes. Hi, Martin.
How you doing, Richard?
And special guest tonight, all the way from the Middle East, it's Ali Begg. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Richard.
Thank you very much for joining us, Ali.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
No. We'll be talking to you later on about your book, Beg to Differ, which basically is a love letter to the Dons. Definitely worth recommended reading for any Aberdeen fans out there. And frankly, if you're listening to this and not an Aberdeen fan, I don't understand why you're listening to this. But unfortunately, Martin did suggest that we skip talking about the St Johnstone game, but we've kind of got to go over it. We've kind of got to try and get to the heart of what the hell happened. How the hell did we end up losing 5-1 at home to St Johnstone? After winning the first 8 games of the season, obviously we slip up at Cali, go out to the Cup at Hibs. I don't think anyone saw 5-1 coming, though. Grant, did you?
I still can't quite believe the game. I mean, I felt quite bad last week after the Hibs game, questioning the attitude of the players a little bit after such a phenomenal start to the season, but Saturday was just totally unacceptable. It was just how a team can go from being so good in the first 8 games to being so bad in the last 3 games. And the most disappointing thing from my point of view is that's 2.5, I would say, out of the last 3 games where we've been outfought. Second half against Cali, I wouldn't put that in the same bracket. But just the desire St Johnstone had compared to what we had, it was just baffling. I mean, to take away the first goal, the first goal is an absolute worldie from Easton. There's no stopping that. But the 4 goals afterwards were just ludicrous. I mean, the defending is unrecognisable from anything we've seen from Aberdeen for a long, long time. And it just comes down to individuals and as a team just not doing their job, just not having that same desire to mark your man, to put your body on the line, to follow the set pieces like they've been doing in the first 8 games. And I think you could see as the goals were going, even the St Johnstone players were just stunned at how easy it was. And the set pieces, I mean, the most annoying thing for me was, after every goal, Aberdeen players were standing in the box, just looking around, with their arms out, looking for somebody to blame. It was not as if there was anybody taking responsibility. And in the past 3 games, I've not seen any leadership from any one of those players out in the park. And I'm really, really surprised by that. And particularly Ryan Jack, who's captain. I'd describe his performance as timid on Saturday. He was just nowhere to be seen. You need somebody. I thought at least one person would step up and rally the troops. But there was just nothing. And I think what the first 8 games of the season showed us is we have the ability in the squad to put in a challenge to Celtic. But I think the last 3 games have shown that mentality-wise, we're a million miles away from being able to do that. And yeah, it's just so, so disappointing.
Yep. Quite right, Grant. Leadership is a word I've got written down here just on my notes to go over the game. And I thought there was a real lack of it on the pitch on Saturday. Obviously, it's Ryan Jack's first season as Aberdeen captain. And this is probably the first time we've had our back against the wall this season, other than perhaps going behind against Motherwell earlier in the season. We'd not really been behind in any games until the last couple. Ali, it's obviously his first season. He's still learning the role. But do you think he's doing enough on the pitch? Do you think he's showing enough leadership?
It's interesting because the notes that I wrote down, I just paraphrased a few notes, and Grant has basically covered all of them in his thoughts of the game as well. What I had basically had written was, the manner in which the game was lost is more worrying than the actual scoreline. Bereft of ideas, lacked leadership, and accepted our fate at 3-1. Now, I found the performance just as baffling as you guys. I was watching on Red TV out here in Qatar. Now, unfortunately, there were technical difficulties with the picture quality, so the pictures were slightly blurred. But I could see enough to see that we were clueless. Now, I had no issues with Ryan Jack being made captain, club captain as well. Not just captain of the team, but club captain, which comes with its own responsibilities. Now, there was obviously a lot of talk last season about possibly Ryan moving on, a few clubs in England sniffing, and at one point it actually did look like he was going to leave. I think Derek McInnes did the right thing in appointing him club captain. I think it was the right time to appoint him the captain of the team, because with that responsibility becomes maturity. Now, it's all fine and good having maturity as a person, but taking that maturity into your profession is a completely different kettle of fish. I think he's been a good captain so far. I've had no issues with it at all, but I was shocked at the lack of leadership on Saturday. Grant was right. When we conceded the goals, especially at the set pieces, every single player put their hands out by their sides and started pointing fingers at each other. Now, that's not good enough. And the captain has got to stand up and take responsibility. And it's the captain that's got to say, it's your man, it's your guy. You've got to pick him up. You've got to do better. Now, I don't know, were we man-marking or were we zonal marking? Because to me, it appeared clueless. And I'm not a big fan of zonal marking. You know, I grew up in the late 70s and the early 80s. Zonal marking did not exist back then. You were told to mark your man, and it was an individual battle against your immediate opponent. And I was always taught, do not ever let your immediate opponent beat you. And I think that's what happened on Saturday. Not just at set pieces, but across the whole game. Everybody that was in an individual battle lost that battle. And that was extremely worrying for me. Why did they lose that battle? Because against Celtic, they won it hand over fist. Against Motherwell, when we went down at Fair Park, we won it hand over fist. We've won all the individual battles at the beginning of the season. Even when we went out of Europe, we were winning individual battles. And on Saturday, it was gone. And that's worrying. And I think that is a psychological problem more than a talent problem. So, to cut a long story short, I have no problems with Ryan Jack being the skipper. I just hope he has the maturity as a person to learn from what happened on Saturday.
Ali, in your past jobs, you will have interviewed guys who have been captain of their clubs, captain of their countries as well, probably. Is there anything that sets these guys apart?
Yes, definitely. You can see the leadership in them. You know, I've been extremely fortunate to have interviewed a lot of very famous football players and captains. Roy Keane, Willie Miller, Alex McLeish, Billy McNeil, Tom Boyd, Graham Souness. These guys are all winners. And they just have something about them which makes them stand out from the rest. It's their attitude to the game. It's their attitude to their fellow professionals. It's their attitude to their job. And they're leaders. They're born leaders. They're just natural winners. And they want to win. They don't care. These guys, they never cared about celebrity. They never cared about the fame. All they cared about was the medals and the honours and the caps. And I know the game has moved on and I know society has moved on. But it's different these days, guys. And I don't know whether the modern day football player has that winning mentality anymore because of just so many issues surrounding the game these days. You know, I'm extremely fortunate to have spoken to Willie Miller about this for my book, and I said to him, what made you a great captain? He said, because I wanted to win. I wanted to win every single game. And with that winning came a maturity, not just in my game, but it improved me as a person. Sir Alex Ferguson gave me responsibilities that I might not have had before. Billy McNeil gave me responsibilities that I didn't have before. And it just improved me as a person and as a professional. And I don't know, maybe there's a lesson to be learned. Maybe Ryan's got to give these guys a call. I don't know. Just a thought.
Well, I mean, obviously it is still very early days in Ryan's leadership at Pittodrie. But Martin, he strikes me as a guy who's going to lead by example, not necessarily one who's going to get up and gee the guys around him up vocally or physically. It's going to be his displays that people are going to look to follow. Do you think there are better options in the squad? I don't see that. That said, I don't see that there's going to be a change made.
I don't think there will be a change. And as like you say, he's going to be a captain that will lead by performance rather than sort of screaming and shouting, much like Russell Anderson was. But I mean, in terms of the squad, who would be, you know, if you're saying who would be a better captain, I think that on Saturday you noticed that Jack's head had dropped down after the third or the fourth. You know, his head was down, and that's when Barry Robson was put on, who, if he was 5 years younger, would probably be an obvious choice for a captain. However, I mean, Robson came on, obviously, it was kind of more than, I think it was really more this damage limitation, trying, like, let's not make this a really horrible kind of cricket score. But I just think that, and there won't change the captain. He's there to be, he is the captain. He's you know, midfield. He's going to stay. But there has to be somebody there to help him. I think Robson was offered another deal, another year at the club, to kind of probably help out Ryan Jack. And kind of just kind of show him, you know, this is what a captain does. This is how you kind of you lead the team. And it just didn't work out. But I mean, everything that could have gone wrong on Saturday went wrong on Saturday. And that's not to just single out Ryan Jack. Everybody was really poor. It was generally like watching. I mean, someone said to me it was like the first day back at school. As we've said, the basic things, second to every ball. But I don't want to just seem to be like we're picking on Ryan Jack here, but. He did have a poor afternoon, but as for captain, I think he'll still stay captain. There's no way that Arban's going to get taken off him.
No, and I think Ali correctly made the point that all over the pitch, we lost those individual battles. None more so than the way that Stephen McLean just absolutely ragdolled our centre-halves, both of them,
yeah,
at various times. And added to that, got remarkable space at set pieces. I mean, I think it was Shea Logan that was detailed to mark him certainly for the first free kick in the first half. But, yeah, I don't know. You can pick apart each and every one of those goals. Well, certainly goals 2-5. I've seen some people have a go at the defending for goal number one, but I'm not too sure what more we could do. You know, when the ball's headed 30, 35 yards out, you kind of feel as if it's out of the danger area, but what a strike it was. I mean, that's the first opposition goal I think I've applauded at Pittodrie for about 20 years. Partly because, of course, there was 3 minutes gone, and I thought, OK, we can still get back into this. So it didn't seem quite so critical at that point in time. But, I talk about a post-mortem. Normally we wouldn't discuss the Ross County game, which is the next game, until the next show, but I think we've got at this point to kind of say, how do we react? How do we change things up? I mean, normally in a situation like this, the reaction to a heavy defeat will often be to go very ultra cautious the next time out. Do you think that's likely, Grant?
To be honest, I think the timing of the international break's been a bit of a godsend on this occasion, because it gives us 2 weeks to sort things out, and I actually don't think he'll make many changes at all. Whether Reynolds is going to be fit, there might be a temptation to throw him back in, but I think he'll give the players one more chance to sort this out. One interesting thing from McInnes post-match, though, was, I remember when we talked to Andy from the Motherwell podcast earlier in the season, and he kind of suggested that Aberdeen had started to build up a bit of an aura, a bit of a worry when opposition teams came to play them. And as McInnes said, Ross County, well, that's been blown out of the water the last three games. Ross County will be pumping balls into our box from set pieces straight away, because every single player, the funniest thing about the game on Saturday was at 5-1 down, after an hour, Craig Brown on Red TV said, "Despite the result, I can't honestly say that any individual has played badly." And I almost fell off my seat when I heard that. I just could not believe it. Did bring a little bit of a smile. But one other thing I was going to point out was something I've mentioned in the past few podcasts is, again, four of those goals on Saturday came in the first 10 minutes of the first half and second half. And I still can't understand why this keeps happening, why we're so vulnerable defensively at the start of each half. Is it a leadership thing? Is it a concentration thing? And I'm sure teams like Ross County now will be well aware of this, and I think that's something else we've got to sort out as well.
So, after, you know, the first 9 or 10 shows was all plain sailing, it seemed. This appears to be not critical yet, still top, but the manner of that defeat. And as I think Ali pointed out, not just the fact it was 5-1, but the way in which it happened raises a lot of questions. And I think, you know, it's silly old me. I mean, after the Hearts game, they actually had me believing. They actually had me thinking, we've got a shout here. We've actually got an outside chance of this. Well, way to disabuse me of that notion, gentlemen. Thank you very much, Aberdeen. As I say, it's the hope that kills you, and very much the case this time. But looking on the bright side, we are still top. We obviously go to Ross County in 2 weeks' time, a chance to go 4 points clear. But that game at Parkhead is looming large, and Celtic will have spotted not just the odd weakness, but a whole heap of them, based on the last few results. So I'd hoped we'd have a more positive intro into our chat with Ali. This time last year, Ali was celebrating becoming a published author, released his book called Beg to Differ. It's pretty much an autobiography, but the focus is on following the Dons. Ali, why choose that as opposed to the other kind of life stories you've got? Because, you know, not everyone's been in a boy band or had the presenting history that you've had. Why choose to focus on the Aberdeen strand?
It was because many years ago I broke my leg very badly in a very innocuous accident. And during my recovery period, unfortunately, due to the nature of my injury, I was unable to carry out my presenting duties because I was in a wheelchair and I had one of these awful metal Elizarov cages wrapped around my leg. So it was very difficult for me to work. And at the time, Aberdeen were just celebrating their centenary year. So I had read many a book about the history of the football club and a few autobiographies, but I was yet to read a book from a fan's point of view. And I'd only just recently finished reading Fever Pitch at the time, and it really struck a chord with me. And I really enjoyed Nick's book, and I just felt I had an awful lot in common with it, like I know so many other fans did as well. And I just thought that I had something different to say. I think because I've been so blessed to have lived quite a colourful life so far, that I could put a completely different spin to it, that I'd be able to tell my story. But the common denominator throughout the book was Aberdeen Football Club and my absolute love and passion for the club. So I just thought I would try it. I would give it a crack and just see how I would get on, really. I think mainly it was just to relieve some boredom during my rehabilitation time. But, you know, as the weeks rolled into months and as the months rolled into years, I just kind of dipped back into it. And because of the way that my career took me, I was just able to add more and more to what I was writing. And I just thought, you know, I think I've got a book here, but I'm not sure. So I just kept going at it. And eventually I decided, look, I'm going to try and turn this into an actual book, because it was also sort of my memoirs as well. And a lot of it was to get a lot of, I suppose, hidden anger, frustration that I'd been carrying for a very long time, and it needed to come out. And I think the only way to get rid of that monkey on my back and to get rid of some of the demons that I'd been carrying was to get it out there and to make it public. But I wanted to keep it positive, and I wanted to write about Aberdeen Football Club, and I wanted people to know that the football club actually got me through what was probably the darkest time in my life. Without them actually knowing that. So hence why I decided, let's write a book, see if a publisher will pick it up, and what the hell, throw it out there and see what happens.
Certainly as somebody who's of a similar age to yourself, Ali, it was a very, very easy read, and each chapter, each new game brought back memories from, you know, my own childhood, going along and watching a successful side and thinking, well, it's always going to be this easy, isn't it? As well as reading like a love letter to the Dons, it also reads as one to your family as well, I think. Was that intentional, or just something that happened through osmosis?
No, it was intentional, because, you know, we were a very close-knit family and we shared all of Aberdeen's success together. You know, my father, he organised the flights to Gothenburg from Aberdeen when we took all the fans to Sweden for the Cup Winners' Cup final. And we never missed a cup final. The only two cup finals that we missed as a complete family were the two Skull Cup finals that we lost to Rangers. And I think we missed one in 1992 Scottish Cup final, I think, if my memory serves me correct. So those were the only finals that we ever missed as a family. So it was vitally important for me to keep that family tie within the book. Plus also, I lost my father very suddenly back in 2007. Very unexpectedly, and it was undoubtedly the worst moment of my life, and it was time to remember my father's memory, hence why, you know, the book is dedicated to my dad, and I wrote it for him more than anybody else.
Now, you spoke about some of the anger that you'd felt. One particular time you touch upon is at the League Cup final in 1995. Yeah. You were in Bad Boys Inc. at the time, and you took quite a lot of stick from Dundee fans in the vicinity of where you were sitting in the main stand at Hampden. And, that's a very telling chapter, I think, because it speaks about some of the anger and speaks about some of the frustration you might have had with the band and these, people not understanding the full story and having a go at you for that.
Yeah, when I look back on it, it was totally unnecessary. It was awful. It really was, and it really took me by surprise because, I'd been used to it. I'd been getting so much stick for 2 or 3 years from, one man and his dog. And I'd got used to it, and I'd kind of built a brick wall around myself, and it always brushed off me, and I wasn't bothered by it, even when publicly, people were having a go at us or slagging us off and all that kind of stuff. And I know that we weren't everybody's cup of tea, because at the end of the day, we were mints, and I have absolutely no problem saying that at all. We were mints, and so we were there to be shot down, and it's fine, and it comes with the territory, and I knew, stepping into that boy band, I would have to face those demons. And I would have to face it full on, and I would have to deal with it in my own way. But that particular day at Hampden, it went too far. And the abuse was very personal. It was aggressive. And it was within the vicinity of my family. And my mother was left in tears. And it was just unnecessary. Just because I'm in a boy band, it doesn't make me some sort of serial killer. It doesn't make me the worst kind of human being. It was just a job. That's all it was. To me, it was just a job. It was an opportunity that I saw to try and make my family financially stable for the rest of their lives, because I'd seen my father go through so much heartache with his own businesses. And I just thought, this is an opportunity to take away that stress and that worry. And I defy anybody, given the same situation as me, that they would not have also joined a boy band. Given talent or no talent. When an opportunity like that is presented at your doorstep, you don't turn it down. It's as simple as that. But it was too much that day. And it made me question everything that I had done in the past 2 years. It made me question myself as a person. What was I doing? What was I thinking? The profound effect that it had on my family was the most upsetting part of that day. And the actual game just went by in a blur, because it was just, it was horrific. And I can't begin to tell you how horrific it was. But thankfully, it was the catalyst for me picking myself up, dusting myself down, and cracking on with my life, leaving the band, facing the financial meltdown that we were looking at the time, and the huge financial hole that I found myself in. When I was only 22 years old, I had to deal with it, and I was the only person that could deal with it with the help of my father, because everyone that was around us, who I thought were there to look after us, had moved on. And had made their money, had moved on and cast us aside. And that was really difficult. That was really, really difficult. That fateful day at Hampden, I suppose, was just, in a way, as weird as it may sound, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because it was in that moment when I was sobbing uncontrollably with my father that I was able to kick on, that I was able to say, right, enough, move on, crack on. We can go one of two ways. We can have a meltdown, or we get on. And I chose the latter option. And, thank God I did.
Yeah, that incident very much acts as a turning point, a pivot moment in the book, I think. But to go back to a more positive memory, I mean, you touched on earlier, your dad was involved in the great airlift from Aberdeen Airport to Gothenburg in 1983, heavily involved. And you yourself, as a 10-year-old, made it to Gothenburg, which I eternally curse you, because being 8 years old, I wasn't allowed to go. So, tell me a little bit about what you can remember about that experience.
Do you know, I swear, Richard and Martin and Grant, you will not believe this. I can remember everything apart from how I reacted when John Hewitt scored the winning goal. It's just gone. It's gone from my memory. I have absolutely no idea how I reacted. I can't see it anymore. I can't picture it. I have no recollection of, you know, did I go nuts? Did I jump up and down? Did I scream the place down? I can't remember. I can remember what happened when Eric Black hit the bar. I can remember when Eric Black scored the opening goal. I can still see the back pass. I can see the penalty. I can see everything. I just can't see John Hewitt scoring the winning goal anymore, and I don't know why. But what an occasion. Oh, dearie me. And I'm really, really blessed. You know, as were, what was it, 14,000?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. I'm really blessed. And it's something that will stay with me for the rest of my life. It really will. And when BBC Alba made that documentary a couple of years ago, my father had an old cine camera, which he took with him. And we'd never, ever got the film converted. And the production company very kindly converted the old cine reel onto a DVD for me. And it was just incredible, because I hadn't seen my father on film ever. And to be able to see my father on film, you know, so many years after he passed away, was just, I can't begin to describe how wonderful it was. And they used a lot of the footage that my father shot over the couple of days that we were there, for their documentary. Yeah, so it was just the most amazing couple of days. And the fact that I got an extra day off school as well, so that we could welcome the team to Pataudry, was an added bonus when you're 10 years old.
Indeed, that was very much an unofficial school holiday across the northeast that day. There's bits in that book which still have a kind of recurring impact on your current life. The chapter which is perhaps most vivid is the one on your knee injury. Ouch. I mean, I recoil just from reading it, Ali. Not so much when the injury happened, which sounded painful enough, but the physio at Pataudry. Oh, how did you put yourself through that? I don't know. How is your knee now? Are we waiting a second operation, or...?
Yeah, unfortunately, so the accident happened in 2003, and in 12 years, I've had 10 operations, and the next operation that I need is a bone realignment procedure, because unfortunately, because of the state of my knee, it just means that I now have a problem of bone-on-bone grinding, which is... unbelievably painful at the moment. So I'm looking at more procedures, but when I'm going to be able to do it is in the lap of the gods, because I just don't have time to do it at the moment. So that will be the next procedure, but I'm extremely fortunate. And again, you know, I've been totally blessed throughout my life. And again, I've been blessed with this injury as well, because I've got such good people looking after me, you know, the highest caliber of people looking after me. Who I've met through my life, you know, Gary Lewin, who's the England physiotherapist who was at Arsenal for many, many years, has been looking after me for all this time, as has Dave Fever, who is the Blackburn Rovers physiotherapist. Dave was the first guy that treated me. So I've been extremely blessed to have known these guys, and they've helped me in the past 12 years try and get this knee sorted. So hopefully next year, after the Olympics, I'm going to come back to the UK and have this procedure done. But eventually the knee's got to come out. In fact, the knee's got to come out now. But I'm too young to have it taken out. And it's gutting because, you know, I've not played football. I had to give up all sport after I broke the leg. It's left me with a permanent disability, unfortunately. And sometimes little incidents happen that remind me how devastated I feel about not being able to play football, because the... Andrew Considine's testimonial committee members got in touch with me and asked me if I wanted to play in the game at half time. And honestly, it breaks my heart. I can't begin to tell you how much it breaks my heart. And I tried to explain to the guys that I couldn't play. So he was like, "Well, we'll stick you in goal." And I'm like, I can't. And he's like, "Well, why don't you come over, bring your son, and we'll let your son kick the game off." Just like, you're killing me, guys, you know. I couldn't get the time off work, and as tempted as I was to come over with little Lennox to do it, I just couldn't get the time off work. But I think I would have found that even more painful knowing my son has played at Pataudry and I haven't.
Yeah, spoken like a real father, that. But you know, I think it is quite interesting. You do again say in your book that you've made sure Lennox has got the Don's tops, and you know, absolutely. You know, when he's old enough, he'll start watching the games with his dad. He's not getting any say in the matter, quite clearly.
No, not a chance. I've already said to his mother, he can get an Austria top, because my wife's from Austria, so Lennox is half Austrian. So he's already got his Red Bull Salzburg top, and he's got his Aberdeen League Cup final top, but it's about three sizes too big for him, because it was the only size I could get. But thankfully, the football club have sorted me out with a strip, and we're going to Austria on Thursday for 10 days, and they've already sent it over to our house in Germany. So so he's picking up his first Aberdeen kit on Thursday morning when we get to Germany. So I can't wait, and trust me, Twitter will be awash with pictures of my son.
Brilliant. And just one more thing for the book. Obviously, I don't want to go into too much detail, because I do think people definitely should pick it up if they've got an interest in the Dons, and certainly if they remember these games, they're going to be, a lot of memories will flood back just from reading these sections. Just one question, for last question on it, Ali. Has James McAvoy got back to you yet?
No.
What a...
Do you know what? I have to say, you know, it was such a surreal moment when he called me and to ask me to do the favour, which I was absolutely, I was thrilled to do it for him. I really was. And I had, you know, as I am, for it doesn't matter that he's a Hollywood actor. Even if a member of the public have called me and said, I'm going to Africa and I'm going to a school and I'm looking for some strips, can you help me? I would have helped them anyway, no matter who it is. But it was just disappointing that after I'd sorted it all out, that we received the radio silence. But hey, so what? You know, at the end of the day, the kids got their strips, and that's the most important thing.
Exactly. Quite right. Ali, thank you very much. Just going to do a couple of quick-fire Don's questions. We're going to do this with all the other guests we got on the show in the next couple of weeks. So, first Aberdeen game.
Kilmarnock, last game of the 1981 season, we lost 2-0 at Pittodrie.
Inauspicious start, that. Last game you saw in the flesh?
League Cup final. No, I'm speaking rubbish. A year ago, when we played St Mirren at home on the Wednesday night, the day before my book launch, when we drew...
2-2. 2-0 up in cruising, absolutely. But League Cup final, again, this comes... I don't want to give up too much in the book, but... it's clearly, again, quite a pivotal moment for you. It's almost like a... I don't know, it's like another point of release, it seems.
Yeah, it was just phenomenal. It was such a great day. And it was the fact that I came home to Glasgow to see all my father's family, you know, my aunties and my uncles and my cousins and all that, and to catch up with some of the old football journalists, you know, who were very friendly with my uncle, who's just recently retired from the profession, and who knew my grandfather very, very well. So it was lovely to meet up with them. And the fact that my brother and I were at a final again together was really poignant for us. And as much as we both missed Dad that day, it was really important that I had my father-in-law with me. So when, you know, Ziggy's Austrian and he doesn't speak a word of English, loves his football, and we dragged him along, and he just had the absolute time of his life. And, you know, he's now a converted Aberdeen fan and looks out for the results every single weekend. And, you know, as much as I speak to him in my very broken German, it was a really special day because I was able to hug him with my brother, you know, instead of my dad. So it was, it was really poignant.
You're very much spreading that Aberdeen gospel, Ali.
And I will continue.
Good work. And just finally, favourite player?
Currently?
Both. Let's have both.
Okay.
You can see I've not thought this through very well, but yeah, that's a...
my all-time favourite player is Rolly Miller, and currently, I've got to go with Niall.
Yep, can't disagree. Yeah. Yeah. I've got to say, I love the fact that football allows 40-something men to say, yeah, I've still got a favourite player, and it's not socially embarrassing, or, well, slightly socially embarrassing, I guess, but, you know.
Although, if there's one thing I can ask about the favourite player is your Dream 11 at the end of the book. When I turned that page over, there was one name that came shooting out from that team, and that's Scott Severin.
Yeah. Do you know what? A lot of people have asked me about that and why I picked him. And honestly, the hardest decision of that team was to pick either Theo or Jim Leighton. And I picked Theo because his save in the 1990 Scottish Cup final is the greatest save that I've ever seen live. And it wasn't just for the fact of the save, it was the whole circumstances surrounding it. Now, for me, Jim is, and will always be, Aberdeen's greatest ever goalkeeper. So I was kind of contradicting myself to why I went with Theo. But he got my vote because of that save. So when it came to Scott, I was very, very torn between him and Neil Simpson. Okay, we could argue to work all day long about this, about who's a better player, different style of player, etc., etc. But I think that Scott almost individually dragged us through what was another terrible period in the club's history. You know, we'd gone through the nonsense with Ebb Scovdal, and then Jimmy came in and just started to restore parity, and then all of a sudden, little glimpses of success were starting to come here and there, qualifying for Europe, beating Rangers again quite comfortably, moving slowly and steadily up the league. I personally think Jimmy's time will always be remembered for the awful cup defeats, and I think he'll only be remembered for that, unfortunately. But I just felt Scott dragged us through that period, and I just found some of his performances and his leadership. You know, and I've spoken to guys that I've played with him, and they said that his leadership is like nothing they've ever experienced before. You know, we spoke about it before about Ryan. And I think Ryan can learn from people like Scott Severin. And that's why I went with him, really.
Well, Beg to Differ by Ali Beg is available via Rudling Heist Publishing, in, as the cliche goes, all good bookshops, but it's also via the usual digital delivery methods. And as I say, definitely worth picking up if you're an Aberdeen fan who can remember a lot of the games that Ali discusses, because it really does bring a lot of those memories flooding back. Something else that will bring a lot of memories flooding back is our cult hero section. Some very popular choices, some very left-field choices. Let's take a couple of the popular ones to start with. Lee Richardson, probably unsurprisingly, picked up quite a few votes. Steve Evans, Neil Scott, Jim Boyle, John McNabb all said Lee Richardson, as did Paul Thompson, who said he was 100% committed, scored some important goals, and wasn't a bad drummer for One God Universe in his spare time. Quite right. I'd forgotten about Rico's sideline in sort of indie rock. Darren Mackey was another popular suggestion. Matthew McInnes, Stephen Johnson, and the guys from Fit By That Bar website all said Darren Mackey, mostly referencing his tremendous header against Kilmarnock, rather than, you know, some of the good goals he actually scored, rather, you know, the one in Dnipro or the lovely chip against Cali. Angel McLaughlin says he was an Aberdeen loon and a player to look up for from her generation. Which, again, it's fair enough. I mean, you know, we do like to see our youngsters come through to the first team. So, you know, he was an honest trier. Let's put it that way. So, Grant, who did you pick? Speaking of honest triers.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going for Eugene Daddy. Just from his very first game, his debut against St Johnstone, when he came on and won a penalty. I haven't seen a player as good at winning penalties without diving as Eugene Daddy. He just always managed to get himself in a position to get brought down, and what a talent it was. It's something he could coach Peter Pollitt about, certainly. But yeah, he only scored 5 goals, but everybody's going to remember the night against Celtic and his turn against Bobo Baldi. Just fantastic. Doesn't get much better than that. So celebrations maybe a little bit over the top at the end, but I certainly enjoy watching those skills on Baldi time and again. And it's just the way the fans took to him, and it was just a shame he only stayed for a season, and I think he's admitted that himself afterwards. It's one decision he always regretted, was moving on. Although, I would say, if he was probably there for more than one season, he probably wouldn't be a cult hero, because, you know, he wasn't the greatest footballer. He didn't score many goals, but, you know, he always put a smile on the fans' faces, and he was just really enjoyable to watch, so that's why I chose Eugene Daddy.
So, Eugene was also the pick of Michael Pirrie, whereas we had a whole host of different selections, quite a few of them from that team, that era anyway. So we've got Roberto Bisconti was the pick of Kenny McIntyre. David Grassi was the choice of the guys at Stats and Miniskirts. That may be with tongue firmly implanted in cheek. Craig Hewson goes for Rashid Belabed. Cult hero if ever there was one, I think. Famously remembered not for his goal-scoring exploits or his ball-winning skills, but for the fact that every game he played in, he tried a ridiculous overhead kick at least once. Gary Stitchell picks Andy Dow, who again, you know, for that one season, 1999 to 2000, just turned into, well, God knows what he turned into, but, you know, he was probably our best player, which probably says a great deal about the rest of the team, other than Andy, in all honesty. Another guy who shone very brightly for a very short space of time was Paul Sheeran, and he was the choice of RC Doig. Ali, who did you go for?
Doug Rugvey.
You can't argue with that, can you? Well, you daren't argue with that. Let's put it that way. You daren't argue with Doug Rugvey. Stalwart of the successful Gothenburg teams. So what in particular was it about him, Ali?
It's almost impossible, whenever you speak to fellow fans about Aberdeen and what Aberdeen Football Club means to us from years gone by, Doug's name ultimately always comes up in chat. I find it impossible, even when I bump into strangers and you just natter away and you're putting the world to right about the Dons, Doug comes up in conversation. And, you know, I grew up in that period when he was our left back, occasionally he was our right back, occasionally he was our centre back. And for a young kid growing up, watching that team, you know, first and foremost, he stood out like a sore thumb. So it was impossible to miss him. But he played with this style. Some people called it clumsy. I thought he was elegant. I loved it. For a guy that was so tall and gangly, I thought he was a great football player. And I think that's what an awful lot of people forgot about Doug Rugvey. They just see this gaping gap in his teeth and think he was just some sort of marauding animal. He wasn't at all. You know, it's like, and again, we can argue the toss about this. And I had this discussion with someone a while ago. Peter Crouch, you know, big lump of a dude. But actually, when you break it down, he's actually a really, really good football player. And, you know, he brings people into play. He can hold the ball up. He scores great goals. He's sensational in the air because of his height. Maybe doesn't get the justice I think he deserves. And Doug reminded me of that. I just thought he was a fantastic football player when all said and done. You know, look at the game against Watershed in the semi-final. He just marauded his way through that defence time and time again, down that wing time and time again. And these poor Belgian dudes had no idea how to cope with him. And I think it was the same in Gothenburg. He goes up for that first header against the keeper and flattens him, absolutely flattens him. And for me, that header set the tone for our victory, because all of a sudden these Spaniards are like, holy shit, we're in a game here. And these guys are coming to win. And I think, again, I had this discussion the other day, actually. I really wish he hadn't have gone to Chelsea when he did. He should have stayed. And I think he would have become an even bigger cult hero if he'd stayed. But maybe that's why he became a cult hero, because he left. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, what I do know is that the Chelsea fans don't quite consider him a cult hero, let's put it that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Which is a shame.
It is a shame. I mean, my abiding memory is the goal celebration, that tutti grin and just arms outstretched, just, you know, in front of the beach end, in front of the Markland end. That's my abiding memory of Doug. Remember, he scored two against Dundee United in a 5-1 win. In fact, I think he scored 2 years running in a 5-1 win against Dundee United.
Can I just cut in? Because, chaps, there was another reason why I thought about it, because if you look at Kevin Sterling's book, which celebrated the centenary year, who's the only player that's on that front cover?
That'll be
Doug Rugvey.
Yeah.
I think that epitomises it, doesn't it?
There were lots of different facets to that early to mid-80s team, and Doug brought another dimension still, I think. You know, you had the culture on the left-hand side with McMaster, and you have Rugvey just marauding up that right-hand touchline. Really good player, and he was difficult to replace. I think McQueen was brought in to replace him initially. Completely different kind of player, good penalty kick taker, but only lasted a couple of seasons. Just to say, Jonathan Black went Rugvey as well. I think quite a few more would have went for Doug. I think he's the archetypical cult hero. I think I prefaced it by putting his photo in the first tweet, and that probably stops people suggesting him, because we do like people to take the left field suggestions. And boy, you've definitely gone left field this week. I can tell you that, folks. So back to the Twitter suggestions. Fosh says Dean Windass. Again, a guy that probably wasn't here long enough, given what he was subsequently able to do down south, but a guy that probably suffered from playing under Alex Muller. Jonathan Norcroft, he of the Sunday Times, says Paul Mason, and that's primarily because of the song his brother used to try and start in a Markland end, apparently, which repeats something unrepeatable about how good Paul Mason was. But yeah, again, a couple of years only here for Paul. Really a bit part player when he first signed, sort of flitting in and out of the team, but will always be remembered for those two goals at Hampden in 1989. And then Callum Shanlon says that he always thought Bobby Connor never got the credit he deserved in the time in the side at the time. And then there's a couple of guys who picked Willem van der Ark, Andy McPherson and Caroline Lowe. And Caroline's comment is probably the best comment we've received all week. He says, love to watch him galloping up and down like a demented giraffe. A demented giraffe. That's fantastic, Caroline. Thanks. Martin, who have you gone for?
Well, I'm aware that this one might get me thrown off the podcast, but I'm going to pick Tony Kumbwari.
Wow.
Obviously arrived in the mid-90s, signed by Roy Aitken. And I'm well aware before anybody points out to me that he was probably slower than a week in jail. He really was just, yeah, there was no, and we know the whole the stories about his alleged, you know, two passports, and he was maybe a few years older than we thought he was. But at that time, I thought he was really good with the ball at his feet. He was entertaining in a good way. He was obviously entertaining in some bad ways as well, because he was very, very slow. And I do love the fact about him as well that on his Wikipedia page, there still has the edit there still has the one regarding the famous shot that almost cleared the Dick Donald stand. That nobody's bothered to go and fix his Wikipedia page. I love that. I thought he was really good with the ball at his feet. He could pick out Billy Dodd's chest from about 50 yards. He seemed to do that every game. I mean, granted, at that time, it did mean that it would hit Billy Dodd's chest, and then it would probably be the end of the move. But that just kind of typifies the time and that side. At that time, I actually did get to meet him once as well, and a few of my friends, so I still get kind of picked on for this one. I went on one of the fans' open days, and he was there, and there was a couple other players. I think it was like Bernard, and I think Derek Stilley was there as well. And I actually have that Living Design top, and on the back of my Living Design Aberdeen top, I got Kumbwari in number 5. Yeah, I'm not joking. I still have the shirt, and I got him to sign it for me. He was really nice. He was absolutely a lovely guy. He signed it to Martin, my friend, from Tony, which just absolutely, you know, I was floating for weeks about it. I think the other players that were sitting there were kind of laughing, which was a bit strange, you know, that given that they'd never played in a European Cup semi-final, so I don't know what they were laughing at, but he scored against Real Madrid, and I think it was the quarter-final he scored in, wasn't it? Yeah. So I don't know what Derek Stilley and Paul Bernard were laughing at, really. But yeah, unfortunately, the signature has long washed off, because I wear that with pride when I'm at away games. And some of the looks I do get are fantastic. You will hear, what the F is that, bloody Kumbwari top and things like that.
So that's you?
That's me, yes. Have you seen me before?
I'm sure I've commented on you before for that exact reason.
Yeah, we... When we were over in San Sebastian for the Sociedad game a year back, I got quite a few shouts. Obviously, there wasn't a lot of Aberdeen fans going about. I think it was maybe 500-600 of us or something. So I got quite a lot of, check the guy with the Kumbwari top. It's like, I'm pretty sure I'm the only person in Aberdeen that paid to get that put on the back of his shirt. But yeah, I absolutely thought Tony was great. Obviously, he was very slow. He did do one of my favourite things I've ever seen at Pittodrie as well, is that the second game that Marco Negri didn't score in, because he didn't score against Celtic and when they drew, the week after he came up to Pittodrie, and there was a great moment in the Aberdeen penalty box where instead of just hoofing it out for a throw-in, he decided, I'm just going to skin you both. And he skinned him, and I think he skinned Brian Laudrup as well. And it was absolutely fantastic. And at the time, we were still young enough to be sitting in the Markland stand, so it was just right in front of us, and we were out of our chair, just absolutely screaming how great Tony was. And yeah, hope one day he might come back as manager. We never know. I still hold out a little bit of hope.
We'll leave Martin now to his dreams of Tony Kumbwari. Just to say that he wasn't actually the only one this week to go for Tony Kumbwari, although I wonder if Ian Carey is maybe Martin under a pseudonym. But again, just to wrap up the last remaining contributions from Twitter, Ilian Kiriakov got a few mentions, Gavin Ross and Drew. Cato Gundveit is the shout of Craig Moyer. Davey Robb is Kevin Rinchley's contribution, because he's old enough to remember him. That's all it takes these days, Kevin, obviously. And then I urge you, even if you're not on Twitter, to go and check this out tonight. We got a contribution from, well, a man who only goes on Twitter by the name Baza, to say Davey Dodds. Because when he was a kid, and Davey Dodds was here, he started the Davey Dodds Foundation and wrote to Davey and got a reply back from him. Got quite a few replies back to him, apparently, and he's kept the letter and he posted a picture of it tonight, along with just a brilliant pen photo of Davey Dodds with his dog in the middle of a street in Aberdeen. It's genius. Please, 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 go on our Twitter feed. I forget what the name is. By the Min AFC, at By the Min AFC, and have a look for this photo. It's fantastic. It justifies the existence of this whole account, quite frankly. It's the best thing I've seen out of it. A month. It's fantastic. And they're clearly professionally done photos of Davey as well. And Davey's not the most photogenic of men, as you might recall.
I was just going to say, thank the Lord.
I'd rather have the dog, quite frankly. Anyway, it's a glorious, glorious thing. So please, please, please check it out. Even if you're not on Twitter, it's worth the effort. So that was Baza's suggestion. The Dodds Foundation. Wow, I hope there's more to come from that, Baz. I hope you kept some of the other correspondence, because that would be great to see. So finally, my shout is going to be Brian Irvin. Now, Big Brian is clearly not as good as the guy you replaced, but frankly, who was going to be as good as Willie Miller? They could have brought in Franco Baresi, he wouldn't have been as good as Willie Miller. Let's be clear about this. But he put his heart and soul into not just every game, but every minute of every game that he played for Aberdeen. You know, he took a lot of stick when he was first called up to the Scotland squad, but he adapted, just like he adapted to playing for Aberdeen and adapted to playing alongside Alex McLeish. And he had a hell of a good goal-scoring record from centre-half as well. And of course, we all remember that penalty kick that won us the Scottish Cup in 1990, and his celebrations, in a way it clearly meant so much to him, because he had been a Dons fan growing up as well. So, Brian Irvin is my cult hero this week, and yeah. Good player, good solid player. And last time I saw him was out in the Ukraine, in Dnipro. He was there for Radio Scotland.
Yeah, he's coaching in China now.
He's in China. I knew he'd been in the States, but I didn't know he was over in China. So
he's got himself a really good coaching gig out in China.
Good to hear.
Probably the nicest man in football, I think, as well, having met him a couple of times.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy, isn't he?
I don't think that's in doubt. Yeah, I don't really think that's in doubt at all. Proper gentleman. So, that's our show tonight. Thank you very, very much to Ali Begg for coming on. Thanks, Ali.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And thank you to Martin and Grant, who picked themselves up off the sofa after the devastating result on Saturday.
Just. Thanks, Richard.
Cheers.
We'll be back next week, and, you know, at least we won't have a 5-1 defeat to look back on. But we'll be looking ahead to Ross County, and we should have Graham Hunter with us next week to chat about the Dons. Good night.